Greetings, this is Reverend Juliet Nightingale, and welcome to this transmission of Toward the Light, Leading Back to the Source. This is a program centered on near-death, out-of-body, and similar spiritually transformative experiences on related topics, including what people should know about the dying process, the many facets of after-death communications, living interdimensionally and being multisensory, intuition and telepathy, and more. We feature special guests who are both experiencers and researchers in the realm of NDEs and related topics. You are welcome to ring into the show and ask questions or make comments. Also, we'd like to let you know that we've got a myriad of services and support available through our organization, Toward the Light, not the least of which is this wonderful program that you are listening to now. We'd like to encourage you to please make a donation. Now, bring Father Christmas along. Help us out a little bit, if you please. Send a donation to towardthelight.org and towardthelight.info via PayPal, or you can send a check or money order. We really appreciate it. Again, for more information, do check out our websites, towardthelight.org and towardthelight.info. This week, I'm very pleased to have a fellow clairvoyant and mystic, one who's been so throughout his entire life, and he is commonly referred to as the photopsychic. With great pleasure, I welcome Arik Smith to Toward the Light. Hello, Arik.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, wonderful, and welcome to Toward the Light. It's really wonderful to have you with us this week. And what I'd like to do is ask you to share with us just a little bit of history. I know a lot of people think about being intuitive, being clairvoyant, what have you, and there are a number of people like you and like myself who have been aware of our gifts throughout our entire life. So why don't you share a little bit about that, and then we'll get into the special work that you have done as a result of this gift and awareness.
Well, I was born with clairvoyant, clairaudient, and clairsensing ability, which means I can I have an inner voice that I hear. I can also see clairvoyantly. And I also can sense things. And to qualify clairvoyance, because there seems to be, you know, a lot of people who don't really understand the word clairvoyant. Clairvoyant is basically you see things a lot of times in your imagination. Sometimes you'll see them outside of your mind's eye as well. But a lot of times you can. Some people call it a mental mediumship, so to speak.
Yes, and that's really important. And you've been able to do this all of your life. And what were some of the special things you did as a child? And I know when we spoke before, it's interesting, you, like me, you thought that everybody did it. And then as you got older, you found out that it seemed to be a little bit more unique.
Well, it's interesting. I still get caught in situations where I will communicate with someone on a certain level, and just by communicating on that level, part of me will assume that person is going to get it on an intuitive basis, when a lot of times, you know, you have to spell things out for somebody because not everybody's thinking on that level. But one of the things I did as a child is I used to love being in a dark room, because, of course, I would see energies floating about in the room. And I've always, you know, enjoyed that aspect of it. People would get afraid of the dark. I actually enjoy lying about in there and seeing things. And it wasn't until several years ago when an outstanding channeler by the name of Summer Bacon, who lives in Sedona, Arizona, asked me if I saw air. And I said, Summer, well, what do you mean? She said, well, do you see air? And I said, well, doesn't everybody? Because I thought that everybody could see energies floating about in the air. And she said, well, no, not everybody can. But I can see things floating about in the air, and I've seen entities behind people, etc.
That's interesting, because I'm the same way. And when I was really, really young, what's odd is that for the first 4 or 5 years of my life, I had no sight at all. I was totally blind. And yet, I saw the most vivid visions and color and light. And then as I started to get physical vision, I could still see the visions that I saw whilst I was blind. And I was actually seeing energy like you were describing. Even talking to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very, very natural to me, and I didn't realize that other people weren't able to do or weren't aware of their capabilities to ultimately be able to do that.
And it's interesting that it's an ability that can be relearned again. There's an excellent exercise that Raymond Moody once showed people how to do on Oprah Winfrey many years ago. You might have heard about how you can go into a dark room like a bathroom with a mirror, and you can train your eyes to look at that mirror in the room being very dark. And after a while, your eyes will become attuned again to seeing things in the dark.
Yes, that's right. And again, Raymond Moody is the author of the book Life After Life, and of course he's somebody that's very much talked about in the near-death experience community. And we've also got the video and DVD, the film based on that book called Life After Life. So if anybody's interested in a copy of that, make a good gift as well. Feel free to look it up on Toward the Light, and it's even on the show info page on BBS site here, and you can order Life After Life. He's done a lot of work with this, and in fact, I think it is when you look, you don't look straight into the mirror, but you're kind of off to one angle of it, and you look into it, and people have been able to see deceased loved ones. In fact, this is something that even goes back to ancient Greece. And I can't remember the word for what they called that, but people would look into water, and they'd also look into mirrors again at an angle and actually be able to see friends and loved ones who are on the other side. This is what you're talking about, I'm assuming.
Yes.
Okay. Now, have you done some of this, experimented with it yourself?
I have, and it's just... It's just something that I already do it anyway, so, you know, I've already been able to see. But one of the things I found looking in a mirror, you can actually see faces more clearly. You can see actual figures of people who have passed on doing the mirror exercise. I find that when I'm just lying about in bed, for example, before I'll go to sleep, I'll see energies floating around, not necessarily physical entities, but I'll see energies a lot.
I do that too. That's loads of fun. And do you find that they're quite colorful and some of them quite luminous?
Yes. And have you ever seen sparkles? When I'm, I
was just going to say yes. I was just going to say.
Aren't they wonderful? And they always come. They always when I see them, and they're like a bright flicker. It's like somebody turning a match on or lighting something. And when I see that, it always makes me feel better. It's like there's something in that to make me feel better about everything.
That's brilliant. I guess exactly the same thing. It's almost like a sweet little cosmic tap on the shoulder reminding me, you're not alone. We're looking after you, or we're with you, or what have you. And I'll actually experience them in different colors. Sometimes there'll be little red lights flickering about. Sometimes they're white. Sometimes they're blue. Sometimes they're violet.
Yes,
sometimes
that's right.
They're green. This is lovely, and likewise, you always get a really positive, good vibe from that when it happens to you.
Yes.
Well, maybe this can be a good encouragement to our listeners to pay attention to that, because I know, now this is interesting, because when I've spoken with a few people, they've described it, and thought, well, bless you, whoever that was. Somebody, you know, would say, oh, I've had this experience, and they think that something's wrong with their eyes or something's wrong with them. And I said, no, that's a very natural, intuitive experience that you're having there, and it's something to pay attention to. But that's very special. So what did you start doing when you evolved into your youth? I mean, obviously, you've taken this gift very seriously, and you've opted to do some very special work with it. So let's get into that a bit, Eric.
Sure. Well, one of the things that in the lead up to the show, when you were asking about, you know, foreseeing certain things that would happen, this ability, as you can probably appreciate yourself, helps you when it comes to personal relationships. You can gauge pretty much who somebody would be that could become a friend of yours, or somebody would be who's maybe not well-disposed toward you for one reason or another, and it can help you. It's like a barometer as such.
Yes.
And I remember the first time when you were asking about prognosticating events, it was Friday the 13th in 1981. I would have been 12 years old, and I was getting a couple of wisdom teeth pulled prior to getting braces, as a lot of 12-year-olds are going through. And I was driving with my mother to the dentist when I was getting before I had this tooth pulled. And all of a sudden, what came to my mind was, as clear as day, I said, "Mom," I said, "something bad's going to happen today." And she said, "Oh, you're just kidding. It's Friday the 13th. I said, no. I said, "Something bad's going to happen today." And we arrived at the office, at the dentist's office. And it's really, as soon as I sat down in the dentist chair, a lot of the staff were leaving because they were visibly upset. And we asked, "Well, what had happened?" And they said, "Well, Pope John Paul II had an attempt on his life in Vatican City."
Wow. Okay, and that was back in 1981.
Correct.
Yeah, and I remember reading that he actually he crossed over. Interesting with all these symbols going on. 33 days he'd been Pope for 33 days, and then all of a sudden he was dead.
You're thinking of Pope John Paul I, because he had died after being Pope only a short period of time, or are you thinking of Pope John Paul II? Because in 81, he had been Pope for a couple of years.
Right. Pope John Paul I.
Yes. He was the one that died rather early.
Yeah, okay. So this is interesting. And then what happened after that? I know that there seems to be a lot of noise at your end. I hope we can have it a little bit quieter here soon.
Yes, I apologize for that.
Lots of noise. It's hard to hear you, so...
Okay, is this better?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
That's a lot better. Thank you. And you also... well, let's back up a little bit, because I know that people are probably curious about the fact that you're a photo psychic. Now, you've seen stuff with... Did the stuff with photos come after that, or have you had a sensitivity to being able to see and perceive or intuit something with photos all of your life, or was that something that was more later developed?
That's something I've really had all my life, but it was triggered by a spiritual teacher I had by the name of Marianne Menard, who is now living in Peterborough, Ontario. The last I haven't been in touch with Marianne for many years, but she gave me a photo of her daughter back in 1997 or 1998, and she said to me, "Eric, I want you to tell me what you're getting from this photo." And I just images and words and feelings flooded through when I looked at the picture, and her jaw dropped. She was just so mesmerized by how accurate the reading was from looking at a picture of her daughter, and that's really what triggered it. But in a sense, I've been doing it my whole life. As you can probably appreciate, it's not so much as the ability itself. It's more or less learning how to adapt it to, the physical realm, the everyday
right.
world.
Exactly. And then, you also saw that Diana was going to be assassinated.
Are you still getting noise on your end? I apologize if there's...
Yes, I am getting noise, definitely.
Would you mind just giving me a brief moment? I'll be right back.
Okay. We are talking with Mr. Eric Smith, and he is a clairvoyant and commonly referred to as the photo psychic.
Sorry about that. Okay, that's better.
Okay, great.
Okay, my apologies for that.
All righty. So I was just letting our listeners know who we're talking to, and this is very, very interesting. And you also foresaw what happened to Princess Diana. Do you want to talk about that a bit?
Sure. In 1997, it would have been, Princess Diana had her death in August of that year. I would say probably 6 months at least before that date, if memory serves me correctly. I was getting vivid dreams, number one, about Diana. She was helping me pick out sweaters, and of course, I like to think, anyone would, you know, feel that that's a pretty normal thing. She was a very beautiful woman, so who wouldn't want to be dreaming of Princess Diana? But when I would see her picture on television, and of course in those days she was campaigning against landmines, and every time I looked at Diana on television, I saw the same energy about her that John F. Kennedy had and his brother had before they died in the 60s. It was the same kind of feeling, and again, Marianne being this lady who I worked with quite closely for several years, I said, Marianne, she's pushing the envelope. She's upsetting people in very high places with what she's doing, and she's going to be assassinated. And this is several months before, and when the actual day happened, as truth be told, I was sitting watching television with my ex-partner, Jenny, and we were watching CNN. And when CNN wrote to the story about Diana's unfortunate death, the first words that came to my mind, my inner voice, which I trust, told me that something happened with the driver. There was something wrong with the driver, and something happened to her neck. And, of course, later on, it was verified that there was something indeed wrong with the driver. And, of course, the neck, that's really hard to verify because there was never really an autopsy, if certainly not a publicly known autopsy on her body.
Right. Now did you know that it was a murder? Did you perceive or foresee that, or just the fact that that she was going to cross?
No, what I kept getting for months prior to this happening was that she was pushing the envelope like the Kennedys did, that she was upsetting the forces that control things on this planet, and that she was going to be assassinated.
Okay.
And then after the fact, I was getting very strongly that Aubrey Paul was the driver itself, sabotaged the car, and was part of the conspiracy to kill her.
Yeah, exactly.
And I got that very strongly. And as I talk to you, it's a very difficult thing to talk about because, to me, she's one of the most beautiful beings inside and out, and she's not only had her body destroyed, but she's also had her credibility destroyed because there's, you know, been a campaign ever since she died to discredit her.
Oh, of course, and that, you know, that's what the powers that be, the shadow people, as they're often referred to, will do. But thankfully, their days are numbered as well, because it, you know, people who are centered in love and who are centered in truth, I mean, just those of those near-death experiences who've been sent back. Why would we be sent back if we didn't have something positive to do that is ultimately going to overturn these dark forces?
Yes.
That's the one thing that I keep coming back to, and in fact I was thinking about it again as I'm reading David Icke's new book, and I just thought, blimey, and I constantly come back to, if there weren't hope for all of this to be turned around, then why on earth would I have been sent back, not once, but several times from the other side? And many of us have been sent back. And then there are the clairvoyants and mystics like yourself who keep coming forward with these truths and insights. And so that right there should, you know, light people up with hope, for sure. Now, you also... you've had conversations with different people. You've also seen some other events. Is that correct? Are there some significant events that you've seen, even such that hasn't come to pass yet, that you would like to talk about?
Well, when you asked me the other day about what I foresaw for the future, a couple of years ago, I clearly saw bombs. Or explosions in downtown Tehran, and I still see that, and I still stand by that even after a couple of years. And I know in the news lately there are stories about how, you know, the intelligence, of course, has proven the Bush and his government to be incorrect in their assessments. But I still see an attack on Iran at some point.
Oh yeah, and. I've actually been seeing that too, and it's interesting to compare notes, you know, seeing some of these events coming up. And I would say that it's vitally important that people trust their own intuition to pay attention to your dreams. But, you know, all of these changes are really pushing people to make radical changes in their lives, you know, even like moving house and all of that sort of thing. In fact, the other night when we were talking about, you know, 2012 and some of these things coming up. Let's talk about that a bit because, it, you know, there's been so much noise about that. And, of course, that, for example, Y2K wasn't as eventful as people were anticipating it would be. And, in fact, I never even got the notion to fill up a jug of water. I just knew that it was going to be totally uneventful, and indeed it was. What are you seeing overall energetically, you know, for the next 3 or 4 years? It's interesting to compare notes, right?
Well, I truly believe. In fact, I would bet any kind of money that I have or will ever obtain that in any major catastrophe that could be linked to a 2012 prophecy that will it'll never happen. The 2012 thing is just in my estimation and my feeling, very strong feeling that it's about scaring people. It's about hype.
Yeah.
And I can draw a bit of historical hindsight to that. Colonel Fletcher Prouty, who I spoke of to you earlier, was speaking about war games in the Pentagon back in the 1940s and how back in the 40s, the Pentagon had already deduced that they could not fight a winnable nuclear exchange with the Russians. So they stopped playing war games at that time, that they basically they saw that there was no winner in any kind of conflict. And as you and I both were old enough to know that, and of course most of our listeners are old enough to know that up until the end of the Cold War there was the fear-mongering, the fear tactics of an imminent nuclear war, and that we should be prepared for it, when in fact they weren't preparing for that at all.
Right. Yeah, in fact, I was born in the 40s, and I could feel this blanket of darkness all over us, you know, in the UK, because, of course, this was World War II period. And all of this, of course, is so deeply and interconnected. And so when you were actually talking to Fletcher. When did that occur, when you were talking to him and getting some of this information?
Well, I began researching a screenplay that should have finished in the next month or so. And I conducted an interview with him in his home in Alexandria, Virginia, back in August of 1999. And I sat down in his living room, and I tried my best to pick his brain. and at the time, it was very nice of him to give me his time, because he was on an oxygen machine, I should say. And he was unable to hear because he was very deaf. And he told me a number of things about what he did in his career, and I was able to get out of him, and it was a lot of things that wouldn't be that you wouldn't have heard in the major media. And I would want to qualify that before I tell you what Fletcher had told me. Fletcher, a lot of people have tried to discredit Fletcher Prouty over years, and weren't able to do so, because everything that he ever said, he was able to back up with some kind of evidence. So he was very careful about what he said to make sure that it was correct. And what one of the things that he had told me, getting back to people who might want to call them light workers, who have passed, John F. Kennedy Jr. had passed away 2 weeks before I spoke to Fletcher. And Fletcher was an amazing character, because Fletcher was the first liaison between the CIA and the Pentagon back in the mid-50s. And he was also, for anyone, any of your listeners that are aware of the movie JFK, he was the character portrayed by Donald Sutherland. And what he told me about John F. Kennedy Jr. was rather interesting, because he told me that John F. Kennedy's plane had blown up. It was a murder. It was not an accident. It was not pilot error.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly what I got too, and I'm seeing lots of evidence of this, and it seems like he from what I understand, he was going to run for presidency, and he had the confidence that he would be able to win as well. I think there was something about running for, I don't recall if it was the Senate in New York, and then also running for the presidency. I'm feeling confident that he would be able to win, and this was against Boy George Bush, I think. And
Before John F. Kennedy Jr. Passed, Pierre Salinger, who I also had the opportunity to speak to on a couple of occasions before he passed back in 97, what Pierre Salinger gave an interview on CNBC with Chris Matthews and said on television that he was told in 1988, some nearly 20 years before, or over 20 years before John F. Kennedy Jr. passed, that there was already a plan in place for John F. Kennedy Jr. to run for the Senate in New York in either 2000 or 2004 and run for the presidency in 2008 or 2012. That was already in place in 1988. And Pierre Salinger told the story of how he learned about this. He watched John F. Kennedy Jr. give a speech at the 1988 Democratic Convention introducing his Uncle Teddy. And Pierre Salinger was so impressed by the speech, he went up to him afterward and he said, John, you know, that was a great speech. When are you going to be running for office? And he said, well, that's not quite that simple. That's not how it's going to work. I'm going to run for the Senate in 2000 or 2004 and then run for the presidency in 2008 or 2012. And getting back to what David Icke has written extensively about, that's how the elite families work. They plan things not tomorrow or the next day. They plan things a quarter century ahead.
Oh, way ahead, yeah. In fact, it was pointed out that the consensus was about Diana that even when she was born, she'd already been targeted to be terminated. She was going to be used basically to. For breeding purposes, and then when they were done with her, they were going to dispose of her, and that's basically what happened. So, you know, it's interesting to see what sort of things were put into place when, you know, John Kennedy Jr. was born and all of that. It's very interesting to note all of this. Now, did you have... You know, when you're looking at some of these people, you know, either in a photograph or on telly, when you're watching telly and stuff like that, have you seen, you know, do a lot of things come to you when you're looking at some of these people and you get strong impressions about them? What has it been something of interest that you've seen more recently?
Pretty much, like you, like whether it be on television or in person, you get images that really they give you like. And this is in everyday situations as well, no matter who you meet. You can't really turn the ability off.
No, indeed.
And when I saw Bush, I remember when Bush was early in his presidency before 9/11, he had a lot of war around him. There was war. He was a war president, even though he wasn't at war at the time. He gave me the impression that he was a wartime president simply by what he was giving me in terms of what I was getting intuitively. And, of course, after 9/11, of course, there's been the so-called war on terror.
Yeah, quote. war on humanity, I think, is more accurate, really.
Well, one of the other things, and I want to take the opportunity to say, because you asked me what I saw in the future, one of the things that I also want to tell your listeners is that what I saw is that around 2012, there are people who are going to be protesters who basically are, you know, go against the so-called mainstream will start to be disappearing, so to speak, and it won't be covered by the mainstream media either. And that's something that, you know, I feel very strongly the need to say it, even though it's a very controversial topic, and I understand that. But I've been getting that very strongly as well, that it's not something that... It's almost like they programmed the public to be so apathetic now that if people were to disappear en masse, it would be a more acceptable thing simply because these people could be basically discredited very easily because, you know, they're conspiracy theorists or they're mentally unstable or whatever they want to call them.
You know, I've actually seen the same thing as well. And in fact, I've encouraged people, don't go out and protest, because that's not really going to serve anything other than to have you monitored and counted, as it were.
Correct.
But instead, do something positive, you know, with your life. And you know, I've been thinking about this a lot lately, especially the past number of days. Instead of opposing the forces that are so dark and really wreaking severe havoc in our world, instead of being in a place of opposition, we need to be in a place of creating and doing something positive and constructive rather than standing in opposition to, because then in a manner of speaking, we're just really lowering ourselves to that same frequency that we're actually in opposition to. So, you know, that's why I like to focus on making music or doing the show, writing, making art, doing something positive, something loving, because, you know, that dark stuff is definitely going on, so we need to replace that with light, but not being combative, not protesting and saying, this is wrong, they shouldn't be doing this, of course they shouldn't be doing it. So we need to be spending more time doing something positive. That's my take on all of this, because also what you were just pointing out, and I've been seeing the same thing, it's very dangerous to go out and protest. And now especially with, you know, the police coming at people with these taser guns and they just use them, you know, just as freely and effortlessly as they want to. So, you know.
Yeah, and may I also say that further to what you were saying about finding creativity in your life, to, you know, to bring it down to basics, because at the end of the day, it's how we treat our neighbor and how they treat us. And if we can treat our neighbors as we want to be treated ourselves, getting back to that old biblical saying, that will help. That'll be like that ripple of hope that Robert Kennedy spoke of many years ago. And over time, and we have to give it time, like these Leaf families do. They don't expect anything to happen overnight, and neither should we. I mean, it's something that we've allowed this to happen, and it's taken many, many eons of time to get to where we are today, and it'll take a long time to get back to a place where we can have peace and tranquility on this planet.
And I think that is something that is utterly attainable. Again, otherwise, why would we have been sent back, or why would people be given these gifts to share warnings and share insights? But I really feel that the light is going to get the upper hand, and that's what we need to be focusing on, is the power of love, the power of creativity, the power of harmony, and the power of light.
And that in itself is, when I teach people intuition, that is the essential ingredient to all of it.
I think so, too. And it's a very comforting energy, and again, you know, when people are doing something positive, and I know this happens to me a lot, that is a really good example of when I'll see those little twinkly lights winking at me, as it were, just reminding me, or it's almost like an acknowledgement, good job, you know, keep it up. And I see those sweet little lights winking at me, and it's very special. Now, something that I'm curious about, when you're looking at some of these people, and it's so fun comparing notes with a fellow practitioner, what sort of things, if you're able to describe this, do you see around people's faces or is it more like a sensation that you get when you're looking at someone's photo, for example?
Well, one of the things I like to say is that because we're all so unique, every one of us, and again, the programming that we get from the media and all the other institutions that have been, you know, doing that to us for so long, people have to remember that each and every one is unique, and we're, as my good friend Ray Helm, who I'm sitting in his living room right now, likes to say, we're all superstars, every one of us.
Yes.
Nobody's
yes.
better than anybody else, and it's something where everybody's different in terms of what I get. And when he spoke of a near-death experience, for example, the last time I saw my mother, before she passed away in 1992, I could feel like a pulsating, a vibrating around her, which I never felt before since with anyone. And literally, it was like she was vibrating. And she had this beautified look on her face. And she wasn't terminally ill. She had a massive seizure that later that night. And it was unexpected. You know, she would have a seizure, you know, every few years. And it would always be in her sleep. And that, but that feeling that I had, that pulsating, I never had with anyone. And yet I could look at someone else. For example, I remember I went to a talk once given by another medium who works with two spirit guides. And one of them, I remember the name was Stefan. And they were so visible behind her. They were like people, but they didn't have faces, but they were images of people. And what I like to do, because I'm a big skeptic myself, I like to question everything that comes out of my mouth because I want to make sure that it's right. I made sure that it wasn't a reflection of anyone else's figure, because as you probably know, when you look at somebody, you're in a well-lit room, the lights can reflect on things.
Yes.
And these figures wouldn't move. They were solid. And I went up to her after her talk, and I said, well, I have to tell you that there are these two figures behind you. And I said, they were two male figures. And she, like, it was like she was expecting it. She said, oh, yes, yes, those are my guides.
Oh. that's really nice. I have, I've just written an article, in fact, it's something that's going to be included in a book, and it's about an ADC, an after-death communication. And I was, when I was in Tennessee, I was in the factory at Franklin, which is it's a former factory that is now an artisan's mall, so there's lots of music and entertainment there, and then very unique shops. Well, I had a loft there at the factory, and, you know, being a medium, boy, I could walk around that place, and it was absolutely teeming with entities. And one of the entities I saw was a rather strange and unique entity in that he was white, but he was a hunchback. And I thought, oh, how odd, I'm seeing a hunchback man. And he was very, very clear to me, so I went up to the front desk, and I asked Alex at the front desk, have you ever heard anything about a factory worker who's hunchback? And he said, Juliet, come here. And he took me to the letterboxes behind the front desk. And up above the letterboxes were these huge black and white photographs. Of course, being visually impaired, I couldn't see them. And especially because they were black and white. So I took out the monocular. He said, look there. And I took out my monocular and I looked at it. Sure enough, there was a picture of the hunchback man that I had seen walking around the factory.
What an amazing story.
It's, and, you know, again, it was so unique. I mean, you know, how many people are going to come up with a short, hunchback, white factory worker in his factory garb and all of that stuff? And there, sure enough, was a picture. The factory sent me, they emailed me the picture of that. So we'll be able to share that in the book. But it's really interesting to have these experiences and then to be able to talk about them and then have them validated.
Yes.
And another interesting thing that I'd like to talk with you about, and I'm sure you experience this again because we both get so much out of photographs, and when I'm looking at photographs of people, it could be my daughter or it could be, you know, friends back in England or what have you. Those photographs vibrate. They come to life, and I experience these different people talking to me through their photographs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some people just say, oh, that's just a photograph. And I say, well, no, it isn't, because photographs are actually used by people, both discarnate and incarnate, to transmit their energy and their messages. Now, I would take it that this has also been your experience as well. Am I right about that?
Well, absolutely. And, in fact, I remember in my previous home where I was living years ago, I would have a picture underneath a lamp, and when I would turn the lamp off, I could see the image from the picture move off the photo. And people have to remember, the listeners have to remember as well, that photography is a very metaphysical exercise, because when you take a picture of somebody, it's an image that's moving from the physical to a piece of paper. So you're literally moving an image via a light. And of course, I mean, which makes perfect sense when you think of the metaphysics of it, of a light transporting something. And I've always been fascinated by the whole transference of light, how it can move literally an image from you to a piece of paper where it can be transposed into a picture.
And then people energetically can channel through those pictures too, and they become really vibrant. And I could tell the difference between a photograph that's just sort of flat looking, just like a regular photograph, and then all of a sudden I can look at another photograph and it will appear to have life.
Mm-hmm.
It will be very vibrant, and even the colors are more vivid, and people are actually able to channel through the photographs, especially people who are crossed over. But again, not necessarily just people on the other side, because telepathy is telepathy. It can happen, you know, interdimensionally as well as, from people who are on the physical plane. Because I get people back in England all the time, and I look at their picture and I say, and I'm really, really aware of them. And then sure enough, I'll get a phone call, or then I'll look online and see there's an email from them and what have you. And this is really fun. I really want to share this because of the telepathy. It's so important. My daughter's in Spain right now. So yesterday I rang her up and she said, "Wow, Mum, at this very moment I was getting the calling card to ring you." I mean, the timing was that precise. We were at the very same moment getting ready to ring each other up, and I just beat her by a few seconds. I mean, literally just a few seconds.
Yeah.
Also, during 9/11, she was in Manhattan, and it was just because of the telepathic connection that we've got with each other that I was able to know that she was all right. Otherwise, I would have been hysterical. So, you know, these are things that I like to share with people to encourage them that this is very natural, and we need to pay attention to this. Maybe we can invite people to call in if they'd like to ask any questions that they might have to you. Now, are there some things that you would like to share about some of the work that you're doing, some things that are coming up?
Sure. I do readings for people, either by, of course, I specialize in reading photos. I don't need a photo to do a reading per se, but a photo will enhance it, certainly. I like to do readings basically by phone and computer. So I would look at somebody's picture, and I could tell the first impressions of the person I'm speaking to over the phone, what I'm getting. And it's a rather fun exercise, even if you do it for a group or any kind of function, because you can literally put up on some kind of a board or something, you know, slides or whatever of people, and you can literally look through them and read them. I also like to teach people how to do the same thing, because I believe that, as we've talked about, I mean, this ability is the case for all of us. For a number of reasons, some of us are doing it on a more active basis, but it's something that we can all do.
It's something that we're all endowed with, I think.
Absolutely. Nobody is more psychic than anybody else in terms of potential. I like to think that there's no limit to my potential, and there's no limit to anybody else's either in terms of that. It's a God-given right that we have. It's a right, like everybody is endowed with it.
And I feel, it's as natural as breathing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I do genuinely get put off when, some of these psychics or their websites will say that the most accurate psychic in the world, or no psychic could measure up to this person, and that whole competitive gibberish, which is nonsense. And you know, that can be quite discouraging to most people, you know, and we need to be very kind to ourselves, regardless of our current level of ability, because it's like a muscle. We need to exercise it, we need to use it, we need to apply it, and it's a very empowering and wonderful thing. And I think with all the changes coming up in our world, especially, for example, when telephones go down, when computers go down, what have you, we are not always going to have access to conventional means of communication, so we're going to have to trust our intuition and trust in what we're getting telepathically. So do you have any advice to share with our listeners about some exercises, some things they can do to, enhance their own abilities and also to help them to trust in their abilities?
The most important thing for anyone to utilize their psychic mediumship, intuition, whatever you want to call it. I don't really like putting a label on it.
I don't either.
but this ability of communicating without using words, the only way you can do it correctly and accurately is to love your worst enemy as you would love your best friend. That you would love your worst enemy, that you would love the person that you would love more than anyone else in the world. If you can get over that hurdle, and I know it's difficult because this planet is a very challenging place. But in order to read somebody correctly, you have to love them enough to get rid of any kind of judgment.
Exactly.
That is the number one thing I can give to your listeners, and also too, to stay honest. And what I mean by that is, when you're doing a reading with somebody, even if it is a practice, ask for validation. And don't be afraid to make mistakes, because people get afraid a lot of times that they're going to make a mistake, and that's how you learn. And the more you do it, the better you're going to get.
That's wonderful. I think we've got a caller. Have we got a caller?
Hello.
Hello, who are we speaking to?
Hi, my name's Adrienne.
Hello, Adrienne.
Hi, I'm calling from Chicago. I was wondering what sort of things you get when you're reading someone who's crossed over. Are you getting messages from them, or?
It's not different than what I get from the physical. In fact, sometimes if I'm not aware the person has crossed over or not, I don't really differentiate. So I get information that comes to mind, and I don't try to, I just go with what I get. So whether it's somebody's living or past, it doesn't really matter.
So say I sent you a picture of my mother.
Yes.
What sort of things, like, what is a reading like for something like that?
Well, my readings tend to emphasize more the health aspect on the medical intuitive. So I'll pick up on a lot of medical issues. I'll get emotional issues. I'll get issues that were in her life, attributes.
Uh-huh.
And I tend to treat it more or less as a statement. And what I mean by that is that I'll give you what I get. But when it comes to specific questions per se, I'll let you validate basically what I say, because questions can sometimes color something, because people will want something out of a reading that sometimes a reader cannot give. You can only give what the statement is, and that statement comes, I believe, from divine information. So, again, divine information is very, very different than what we're kind of accustomed to being aware of, and, from influences like the media and all of this.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good point, too, Eric, because I remember one time I was giving a reading to somebody, and it was her birthday, and she asked me, is my mom proud of me on my birthday today? That sort of thing. And I said, to be honest, I'm not really getting anything about your birthday, because, and this is a very important point, on the other side, we're not really aware of names and dates and that sort of thing. In fact, during my big NDE in the mid-70s, I actually flatlined and died on my birthday. But from the vantage point of the other side, I was not aware of, oh, it's my birthday. There's no sense of time or date in that regard. And just like Aidan, what Eric was pointing out, is that a soul, whether on this side or on the other side, is still pure consciousness. And so that consciousness can communicate across all boundaries. And again, it doesn't matter if from the other side or even on this side of existence. And I go to the same thing. I'll say, I'm getting something from so-and-so, and then somebody will say, well, that person's dead, and I said, well, the body may be dead, but I'm getting something. And so it really is hard to differentiate, because the consciousness is still very much intact, whether from the other side or still on this plane of existence. So that's a really good point to make up. We've got just a couple of minutes or so. Did you have any other questions that you wanted to ask?
Just how I can contact Mr. Smith.
Go ahead, Eric. What's your contact information? Good question.
There's two ways. You can reach me by email, which is really easy. My email is ericsmithpsychic@yahoo.com.
And why don't you spell out your name, lad, so everybody gets it right?
Okay, Erica. That's E-R-I-C Smith, S-M-I-T-H, psychic@yahoo.com. And my phone number, you can reach me as well, is 778-686-3742.
3742, okay. Okay, thank you for your time.
Oh, you're welcome, anytime.
Thank you so much, both of you.
Thank you.
Blessings to you. Thanks for the call. Well, that's really nice. And actually, I'm going to be building a page for you, too, which will be on towardthelight.org, so people can contact you via that, too. And it will be towardthelight.org/Eric Smith.
Thank you.
So
that's very nice that you're doing that.
Yes, I'll happily do that, and that will be up in just a few days. So as soon as I get my internet connection back up, I'm temporarily down. We've got just a couple of more minutes. Is there anything that you would like to share with our listeners before we sign off for this evening?
I would be. One thing that came to mind during the last question was anybody going for a reading, not just with me or with Juliet, but any other reader. One of the things I like to caution people against is, you see, television likes to let people know, or likes to try to tell people that psychics have all the answers. And I can tell you that one of the best ways to confuse a psychic is to ask some questions. Because you'll know a genuine psychic when they tell you something. Because if you ask them a bunch of questions, you're going to cloud even the best psychic's judgment, because you're going to be giving them things that may not be coming to them naturally. And I like to always say that questions can, a lot of times, they can cloud the psychic. So the psychic will tell you how good they are simply by telling you stuff rather than you telling them stuff.
Although a lot of times when I give a reading, I ask people what they want to focus on, because I know that they've got specific things in mind that they're wanting to focus on. But that's a very good point that you're making as well. If people say, for example, well, I'm wanting to focus on my career, for example, you know, and then we can start to tune into that area of their lives. Or somebody might have an issue with their health, and so they might compel us to focus in on that. There's such a myriad of ways that people can actually tap in and tune in to someone and the issues that they're needing to discuss. But I think it's really, really wonderful that you've been sharing with us today, Eric. Thank you so much for being with us on this transmission of Toward the Light. And again, I'll have that web page up for you so that people will easily be able to reach and contact you in Vancouver.
Such a pleasure for me, and you know, thank you for having me, because sharing energy with you is indeed a pleasure, because, as I've already told you, I mean, you're such a clear and open person and such a kind person, and that's a quality I believe surmounts any other quality that anybody can have.
Well, thank you so much for that, Eric. You're such a gem, and I've got to say, some wonderful, wonderful souls have come to me as a result of this great, great show here, Toward the Light. And it's such an honor to share with everyone. I hope you're having a wonderful winter solstice, which actually was yesterday, and the coming of a new light here on the 25th, as we'll start to see more of the sunlight expanding. I hope everybody has a wonderful next several days. Next week we're going to have BBS Radio fellow host, and her name is Katie Romero, and she's done a lot of work with Spiritual Hollywood. She also is a fellow near-death experiencer, so we're going to be talking to her next week. You have been listening to Toward the Light, Leading Back to the Source, and this is a reminder that it is only with the heart that one can see rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye. Please remember that only love prevails. Blessings and light to all of you. We will speak to you next week on another transmission of Toward the Light.